Welcome to the Jacksonville First Seventh-day Adventist Church podcast, where we listen, learn, and love together. Our speaker today is Pastor Jonathan Pinato.
Father, I ask that you make us aware of your presence. We just read in the book of Acts how the Apostle Paul was reasoning with the philosophers in Athens. And he shared with them that it is in you who we have our being. We move and we live and we breathe in you. That you are our Father. And so I ask that even right now, that you may heighten our awareness and our consciousness of you and of your presence. And may we leave this place with a renewed commitment to live every single moment in your presence. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. One of the greatest challenges in today's world is that we are living in a secular society. What does that mean? That means that we are living in a society that has no awareness and no consciousness of God. Our society is living their lives hidden from the presence of the Lord. Living life outside of the presence of the Lord. Our society and culture has little to no consciousness of the Lord and of His presence. Over the last 300 years, the ideas advanced by the Enlightenment, and that is the age of reason, that is of humanism, the ideas advanced by humanism that man is the sum of all things. The ideas advanced by materialism, that is that the material world is the only thing that is real, is the only thing that exists. The ideas proposed by scientific naturalism, that is that all things continue as they have, that we live in a closed system with no supernatural intervention. The ideas advanced by atheism, they have all done their work in our lives. We have all been affected by it, and as a result, society at large lives oblivious to the presence of God. We live in the here and the now. Our focus, our effort, our minds, our life is about the material world. What will we eat? Oh, I'm sure some of you here are hungry, wondering, when will the pastor, how long will his sermon be? Because I want to eat. What will we eat? What will we drink? What will I wear? Well, I've already had that clothes for about a year or so. The season has changed. The fashion's different now. What am I going to wear now? What am I going to drive? Have you heard about ride pride? What am I going to drive? Is make sure my car has certain rims and certain, you know, features on it. And how much do I earn? How much do I have? How much will I earn? Where will I live? Because I have to live in the right neighborhood. I can't live in that neighborhood because it's not a really nice neighborhood. I have to live in this neighborhood. What about my career? What will I consume next? American society is spoken or described as a consumer economy. No longer a manufacturing economy, but a consuming economy. How can we have more pleasure? How can we have more leisure? And so the question is, where is God and His presence in our lives? Have we also been sucked into these things? Where is God and His presence in our life? Where is the church in our life? If we were to do an inventory of our top values and of our top priorities, where would God land? Where would He land? Is He number one? Or is He number two? Or maybe God is number three? Or maybe even lower. What about the church, though? If God lands at number three, because work is number one, money is number two, God is number three, then where would the church land? Four, five, six, seven? Who knows? I mean, because we show up to work every day, right? Whether we feel like it or not, but, oh man, if I don't feel like going to church. Well, it's the Sabbath anyways, right? It's a day of rest, right? And I have to get my rest in. lay activities. Mercy, mercy. Right, and there's a balance there somewhere, right? There's a balance. But if we were to do an inventory of our top values and priorities, where would God land? Where would the church land? Where would money land? Where would comfort and convenience land? Where would fashion land in our values? Where do friends land in our value system? Where does status and stuff and reputation and entertainment land? If something is important to you, you make time for it. You focus on it and you make time for it. If you say relationships are the most important thing to you, then that means you will spend time at home. You will spend time with your family. You will spend time with your children. But if you say relationships are the most important thing to you, but you're never home, is that really one of your top values or priorities? If I say that God is the most important thing, but then I never spend time in prayer, I never spend time in scripture, I never spend time in spiritual things and in spiritual activities, if I never spend time at church, going to church, then the truth is that we are living a material lifestyle. We are living outside of the presence of God. In fact, I remember the words of Jesus. They just came to my mind right now, where Jesus said, "Don't worry about what you will eat or what you will drink or wherewithal you will be clothed. For the pagans and the Gentiles, they're the ones who seek all these things. But you seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And then all these other things will be given to you." Living outside of the presence of the Lord, however, is not new. It's not new to our current secular society. It has existed since the earliest of times. And why do I share this with you? I share this with you because I just came back from France and from Europe, and it's unbelievable every time I go back there how secular the environment is in Europe. And how secular it is in France. As soon as you come off the airplane, you can just feel it and you can just sense it, that people there are living without the consciousness of God in their lives. God doesn't even fit anywhere in their mind, in their value system. God doesn't exist in their minds and in their life and in their value system. But living outside the presence of the Lord, however, is not new. It's existed since the very beginning. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 14. This is Cain, and he is saying, "Today you are driving me from the land." He's blaming God for his actions. He's not taking responsibility. And then what does he say? "And I will be hidden from your presence. And I will be a restless wanderer on the earth." And so Cain went out from the Lord's presence. And he lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. The land of Nod means the land of restlessness. And I'm just reminded of the words of St. Augustine, where he says, "Our souls, O Lord, are restless until we find our rest in Thee." Society at large is living their life outside of the presence of God. Now, let me tell you something. I love France. I love France. I love Paris. Contrary to popular opinion, I don't know if you've heard this, but I find the people of France to be very lovely, very polite, and very cordial. Right? There's that idea that French people are rude. Not my experience. No. Yes, the French will only speak French to you. But can we hold that against them? We live in America, and Americans, we only speak English, right? You know, and then we go to another country, and we expect them to know English, right? And what do you mean you don't speak English, right? You know, so we can't hold that against the French, right? Yes, they only speak French, but just like us, they think everybody else in the world should also speak French just like them. Just like we think everybody else in the world should speak English, right? Because it's the best language in the world, right? Because we speak it. But I love France, I love Paris, and I was able to get to know a little bit more of their culture, and there's this beautiful custom that they have in France where they greet everyone. Everyone is greeted. And no, I don't speak French. There's only three words in French that I know, and that's bonjour, which is good day or hello. That's how you say hello. And you say bonsoir, good evening, and you say au revoir, goodbye. And every person that you meet, you can't walk into the store, you can't do anything without someone saying bonjour to you. And then when you leave the store, they say au revoir to you. And I think it's beautiful because it is an acknowledgement of the person. I see you. How are you? Good morning. I recognize and acknowledge that you walked into my store, and I'm thankful that you walked into my store. And then as you leave, you don't just leave. You tell them good day, thank you. You know, and there's this acknowledgement of the person. I think it's such a beautiful thing. And it was hard because when I came back here, and I don't know if it's me or if it's the culture at large, but I come back here and I'm not making eye contact with anybody when I go into the store, and nobody acknowledges me when I go to the store, and I don't acknowledge anyone that we go to the store, and I leave, and there isn't that personal touch. And I saw that in France, this I see you, I acknowledge your person, I acknowledge your being, and I thought it was wonderful. And then I also learned that there's this culture, there's this beautiful culture in France, especially in Paris, that whenever you visit someone, you take some flowers. He takes some flowers to them. And I said, wow, isn't that so beautiful? And I was like, maybe, you know, when I go on pastoral visits, right? And I visit someone and they have flower shops all over the place. You know, what if I do my pastoral visits and I bring a flower? Would you guys like that? Would my parishioners like that? I bring some fresh flowers, you know, to you. Can you pass that out to the ladies there? Hopefully we have enough. But I was like, man, that's just such a beautiful custom, such a beautiful thing, the practice that they have, just giving flowers to everyone. I love France. I love Paris. Paris is a city like no other. It is rich in beauty. It is rich in culture. It's rich in history. And if you were at the Sabbath school this morning, it's rich in fashion as well. And it's rich in architecture and design. It's rich in art, in sport, and botany, the gardens. You should see the gardens and the plazas and the green spaces of Paris. I love it. I love it. And our goal this time, as we return, this is our second time there, and our goal this time was to go deeper into the city, was to learn more of the history of the city, to learn more of its cultures and of its values. And so we spent quite a bit of time in the museums with tours and with tour guides, helping us to gain a greater appreciation and understanding of this city. And so as we begin the tour, one of the very first things that I learned was regarding the architecture, the design, and the urban planning of the city. When you look at this picture behind me, how many stories is that building? How many stories is that building behind me? Six, seven? It's a little blurry, you're right. It's a little blurry, it's a little dark. There's eight stories, right? All right, there's eight stories. There's eight stories. And though some are six and some are seven, but there's eight stories to this building, and that's eight stories is the cap in certain sections of Paris. They will not build their buildings taller than eight stories. And the tour guide was sharing this with us and was telling us that Paris has gone through several experiences of urban renewal, where they will completely tear down a neighborhood and then rebuild it from the ground up. And I had a few questions about that because I wondered what happened to the people who were living in those buildings, and then they build these luxury apartments afterwards, and what happens to those people? But the tour guide didn't talk about that, right? The tour guide just talked about how beautiful these buildings are. But the tour guide is telling us that Paris has gone through several times of urban renewal where they would completely tear down a neighborhood and rebuild it from the ground up, and they would cap the buildings at eight stories tall. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And he says, yes, because the number eight, the tour guide tells us, represents a human scale. So the tour guide said, the number eight represents a human scale. And I was like, well what do you mean? What do you mean by human scale? And he said, well, in architecture, the human scale has to do with the accessibility of humans in terms of distance and height. Distance and height. Whatever a human being can walk, within a certain amount of time, a certain amount of distance, and whatever a human being can climb with a certain amount of height. Contrasted to the United States of America, where we have built our cities not to a human scale, but to a automotive scale. Whatever distance the automobile can carry us, right? And so in my neighborhood, it's about 4 miles from where I live to the nearest store. 4 miles, right? In a car, 5 minutes, right? How long would it take me to walk 4 miles to get to the nearest store? Right? You know, yeah. Whew. You know, it's impossible. It's not doable. You know, that's why you don't see anybody walking here in the United States of America unless they had their license revoked and, you know, for drinking and, you know what I mean, that kind of stuff, right? No, I'm just kidding, right? But in Paris, the nearest store is about 400 meters. You know, 400 meters, that's less than a quarter of a mile, I think. I mean, or just about that. I mean, it's you can walk there in 5 minutes. Right? A human scale. And I started thinking about that a little bit more. And I think that there's something to the number 8. I don't want to speculate, so I won't say it here. But I think there's something a little bit more to the number 8. But the idea is, the focus is human scale. We're going to build our buildings to a human scale. The focus being humans and man. Now, I think there's benefits to that. But I just found that interesting, that even in their building and their architecture and design, the focus is humanity. Now, maybe I'm reading too much into this, I'm not sure, but the tour continued. And in the tour, we come around to the Champs-Élysées, and the Champs-Élysées is an avenue in Paris. You can, it's very famous. That's the Champs-Élysées right there going towards the Louvre. And then this is the Champs-Élysées. The picture here was taken from the Arch of Triumph. This is going in that Arch of Triumph. And then behind there you see La Défense with the modern skyscrapers and things like that. But that's the Champs-Élysées. Beautiful boulevard. They've built gardens closer to the Louvre. And then the stores that they've built on the Champs-Élysées are just incredibly, incredibly lavish, incredibly luxurious. The fanciest stores that you'll ever see. In fact, I did not believe it until the tour guide told us, and I didn't want to test it out, but the tour guide told us that many of these stores, they're so fancy, they're so exclusive, that you can't even walk into them without a reservation. You walk in, and someone meets you at the door. I'm sorry, do you have a reservation? No, I don't. I'm sorry, you're going to have to leave the store. I mean, to talk about exclusiveness, you know? Unbelievable, unbelievable. But they're just incredible, the incredible stores. I mean, it's just incredible on the inside. I mean, it's what they call window shopping. That would be me just looking through the window, trying to see what I could see in there because they can't let me in, right? And then eventually they would shoo me away from even looking in the window. Oh, incredible, fanciest stores. As exclusive as you can get. And then the tour guide tells us that this avenue, the Champs-Élysées, and I'll go back here, that this avenue, the Champs-Élysées, that it takes its name from Greek mythology. The Champs-Élysées in the Greek is really a reference to the Elysian fields, or Elysium. And in Greek mythology, the Elysian fields was the place where the worthy righteous and the heroic dead went. It was paradise. Elysium was a beautiful garden with trees, and it was idyllic, and it was peaceful, and there were fountains, and there was waters. And then I start thinking, and then here in Paris, they've built the Champs-Élysées. In other words, the humanistic symbolism continues. Is that Paris here on earth? Paris is heaven on earth. We're looking for the New Jerusalem up in heaven. Well, you have to look far, because we have Paris. Paris is paradise. The Champs-Élysées, everything you could ever want. The trees and the gardens are there, and the fanciest stores, and the gold, and the glitter. A focus on humanism. Well, maybe I'm speculating a little bit. Maybe I'm speculating. But then the tour continued, and this is a picture of the Parthenon in Athens, Greece, on top of the Acropolis. In fact, this was the very place where the scripture reading that we read this morning, Nicholas read for us, Acts chapter 17, this is the location where Paul is having this conversation with the Greek philosophers on Mars Hills, very close to there. So Greek has the Acropolis, the city on high. It has the Parthenon shown behind us. The Parthenon where the Greek goddess Athena was there along with the other Greek gods on top of that temple. We went to Rome last year. And Rome also has a Parthenon, but they call it the Pantheon. And it was there in the Pantheon where all the Roman gods, all the Roman pagan gods were there. And you could see it. And then we learned in the tour that Paris also has its own Pantheon, right? The word Pantheon being pan, being all, and theon being all the gods, theos from theos. That Paris also has its own Pantheon. And I was intrigued by this. In Paris, there's a pantheon, but it's not dedicated to the pagan gods. Do you know who's enshrined there? The great thinkers. This is a picture inside. In fact, it used to be a church to the patron saint of Paris, which is Genevieve. It used to be a church to Saint Genevieve, but after the Revolution, after the French Revolution, it was turned into the Pantheon. The great thinkers, the great philosophers, the leaders, and the outstanding citizens of the nation of France are enshrined there in the Pantheon, the place of the gods. Interesting. Now, they could have called it a memorial. I mean, we have memorials, right? And I don't think there's anything wrong with remembering the great men of the past. And we go to Washington, D.C., and we see the Lincoln Memorial, Abraham Lincoln. There's a sculpture of him there. We see the Washington Monument. You see the Jefferson Memorial. I don't think there's anything wrong with remembering great men of the past, but maybe I'm reading into it. But they could have called it something else other than a pantheon, don't you think? You see, that name implies the deification of man. Humanism. Humanism in architecture, humanism in design, humanism in urban planning, humanism even in its memorials. And we continue to the Louvre there, incredible art museum. They have so much there. And this used to be the palace, but afterwards, after the Revolution, it turned into a museum. And as we were walking through the Louvre, we came across this room here, which is called the Apollo Room or the Apollo Hall. And as we were walking through this room, I noticed just how opulent and extravagant this room is. I don't know if you can tell here in the pictures, but it's just adorned incredibly, and they have these sculptures and statues that are coming out, 3D hanging from the ceiling, just coming out, and lined up all against the wall. There's paintings, and lined up all against the wall are portraits of the kings of France, and there in this room are also the crown jewels of France. This room is so extravagant. It's probably one of the most extravagant rooms in all the world. It perhaps rivals in lavishness only the Vatican. And maybe it does even a great job of competing against the Vatican and their museums and their rooms there. And there are diamonds there, and there are sapphires there, and there are emeralds there, and jaspers, and rubies, and pearls, and gold, and silver, and crystal. And lined against the walls, I said, are portraits of the kings of France. And as I'm in this room, and I'm just being blown away by all this extravagance, the thought came to me, because I made the comparison to the Vatican. And I said, Rome gives glory to man, albeit it is a religious man, the Pope. But France also gives glory to man. However, it is not the religious man that France glorifies. It is the secular man. You see, both of these extremes, they're two opposites of the same coin. In fact, you could almost argue that the one leads to the other. And then as we continued there in the Louvre, we came across this other painting, and this painting here, and you can just tell how large it is. But as you zoom into this painting, and we're gonna zoom in like right here to this section here. As you zoom into this painting, this is what you see. It is a painting of the crowning of Napoleon. And what took place is that the Pope is the one who used to crown everybody back in the days, because the Pope was seen as the ultimate authority. And here is the Pope right here. And as the Pope is about to crown Napoleon, Napoleon takes the crown from his hands. He says, "Thank you very much." He takes it, and he turns to the people, and he crowns himself. What do you think about that? I am sufficient to crown myself. I am above the Pope. I am above everyone. I have the authority to crown myself. Oh, what a message. What an incredible message this is sending. You see, France is the climax of a Western civilization. And as amazing as it is, as much as I love France, as much as I love Paris, it is just the epitome of humanism and secularism and the complete opposite of everything that we stand for and everything that we believe. That is God, and making God the number one value in our life. What do you think, compared to what God is offering us, what do you think about Paris? Is this it? Is Paris everything? Is this everything that humanity has to offer? There is also humanism in the arts. We visited the Orsay Museum, and it used to be a train station, and but they turned it into, they were thinking of tearing it down, and they decided to turn it into a museum instead, and that's just the picture there. So the selfie, evidence that we were actually there inside the Orsay Museum. And inside the Orsay Museum is where a lot of the Impressionist paintings are. And I'll share a little bit about that with you in my next sermon here. They have the classical paintings, the realist paintings, and also the Impressionist paintings. But in the back of this museum, just below where that's the entrance over here where the large clock is, and we're on the opposite side, and just below us there, they have a special exhibit. And they have an exhibit of the old Paris Opera House. And so you walk there, and they're highlighting the old Paris Opera House, and it's a beautiful building. But by the time you see so many amazing, beautiful buildings, it's like, well, just another beautiful building, no big deal, right? And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's nice, the Opera House. And then I learned that this same Opera House is the Opera House that inspired the Phantom of the Opera. It was this Opera House that inspired the Phantom of the Opera. And I was like, oh, that's a nice bit of information there to learn. And then underneath in the museum exhibit, they have this miniature display of that particular neighborhood in Paris where the Opera House is. And I was like, oh, that's nice, this glass display on the floor. And then the tour guide tells us that this section of Paris also underwent various renovations. And in one of those renovations, the entire neighborhood was torn down. New streets and new buildings were erected in their place. And can you guess what was at the center of these neighborhoods? Can you guess what was at the center of these neighborhoods? There was two spaces that were center, that were the center, that marked the center of each neighborhood. Number one was the plaza. If you go to Latin America, we still have the plazas, right? That marks the center of the neighborhood. And there was also a church that would mark the center of the neighborhood. So there would be a plaza and a church. And as they tore down this section of the neighborhood and they rebuilt it with new streets and new buildings, they rebuilt the plaza. Do you think they rebuilt the church?
No.
In the center of the neighborhood, they built that opera house. They built the opera house. Do you know what message? What message that's sending? The church is no longer the center of life in this neighborhood. It is the opera that will now be the center of life of this neighborhood, not the church. I found that to be very, very powerful, especially considering the successor today of the opera, which is the entertainment industry and Hollywood, and how central entertainment is to our lives. Our whole society revolves around the entertainment industry. We live in Florida, and Florida is known for Disney World. You know, nothing against Disney World and nothing against the parks, but our whole economy revolves around this. Very interesting message. And then I took more interest to understand and to learn a little bit more. And the tour guide then starts sharing with us and a little bit more about the opera house. And they tell us that when this opera house was first built, it was intentionally built to be the most lavish of all buildings that there were up to that day. People would come to the opera house not much for the show, but rather to be seen inside the opera house. And look at that hallway. I mean, isn't that amazing? It's amazing, you know. I mean, I don't know what our opera houses look like or what our theaters look like, but they don't look like that. This opera house was a place of status. It was a place of vanity and of glory. If you were anyone in Paris, you would be at that opera house. You would be seen inside that opera house. This is the seating area of that old opera house. It seats about 2,000 people. And then they also had an exhibit. Let me just show you here. This is important here because this is the stage. This is the stage right over here. And this is the seating area of 2,000 people. And they had small models of the sets. They had miniature models of the sets that would go onto that stage. You see this little wizard here, just for perspective. That little wizard was about, you know, this tall, right? In the model, right? It's a miniature model, right? But they showed us, and they had various sets that they would put on the stage, and they would just, they would just kind of move them in various sets. And then they told us that the stage. Now you remember the stage. Let me show it back to you again. Let me show you the stage again here. Remember the stage. They told us that the stage, that you see it there, was actually at least 2 times larger than the seating area. And they have a cutout here of, do you see it there? Okay, here it is. This is the seating area. 2,000 people fit in there. This here is the stage. Can you imagine that? With all the ropes and with all the pulleys and with the sandbags and the movement of the sets. And this opera house is being built during the 1860s and the 1870s. And I'm learning about this opera house, and then I remember, wait a minute, 1861 to 1875, there was somebody living during that time here in the United States of America, in Michigan, in Battle Creek. Can you guess who that was? A woman. Ellen White was alive. And wait a minute, I remember Ellen White writing something about the opera and the theater. And I read her statements, and I want to share her statements with you about the opera and at the theater, and all of a sudden it made sense. And I have a greater appreciation for what she said. Are you ready for the quotes? Quote number one, remember a contemporary, she's living during the same time this opera house is being built, and she says, through drama, Satan has worked for ages to excite passion and glorify vice. The opera, with its fascinating display and bewildering music, the masquerade, the dance, the card table, Satan employs to break down the barriers of principle and open the door to sensual indulgence. Isn't that what the entertainment industry is all about even today? She continues, in every gathering for pleasure where pride is fostered, remember, this is the tour guide telling me, right? Why did people go to that opera house? Was it for the shows? No, it was to be seen there. It was to be seen there. It was about vanity. It was about glorifying themselves. In every gathering for pleasure where pride is fostered or appetite indulged, where one is led to forget God. And what did I say about modern day secular society today? God doesn't even enter into our minds. We've completely forgotten about it. where one is led to forget God and lose sight of eternal interest, there Satan is binding his chains about the soul to banish Christ from the mind, living our lives outside of the presence of the Lord. Here's another one. I have three more quotes for you, if you don't mind. I was sharing with you when I was visiting the churches in Michigan, I noticed that the pastors quoted Ellen White a lot in their sermons. They had like 10 or 15 quotes from Ellen White in every sermon, and I don't typically do that, but I'm going to do that today. Is that all right? Amen. Among the most dangerous resorts for pleasure is the theater. Same, the opera and the theater is similar back in her days. Instead of being a school for morality and virtue, as is so often claimed, it is the very hotbed of immorality. You know, what is it that sells in pictures? Sex, violence, what's the other one? Money, I don't know, you know? And the more sex, the better. The more violence, the better. The more graphic it all is, the better. It is the very hotbed of immorality. Vicious habits and sinful propensities are strengthened and confirmed by these entertainments. Low songs, and what she means by low songs, she means vulgar songs. Low songs, lewd gestures, expressions, and attitudes deprave the imagination and debase the morals. Every youth who habitually attends such exhibitions will be corrupted in principle. There is no influence in our land more powerful to poison the imagination, to destroy religious impressions, to blunt the relish for the tranquil pleasures and sober realities of life than theatrical amusements. I mean, just stop there, you know? I'm a young person, and I used to be a young person, you know, and I still think I am, and maybe some of you still think I am, but I remember you asked me when I was a teenager, you have a chance, Jonathan, to go to prayer meeting, or you have a chance to go to the movies. Right? No competition, right? You know, you have a chance to go to Disney World, or you have a chance to go to church. What are you going to pick? There is no influence in our land more powerful to poison the imagination, to destroy religious impressions, to blunt the relish for tranquil pleasures and the sober realities of life than theatrical amusements. And when we see it and when we experience it, we want something more, and we want something bigger, and we want something louder, and we want something better. That's why we think the movies from the 1950s are lame, right? You know, we want something more, and it has to be more, and it has to be more. The love for these scenes increases with every indulgence as the desire for intoxicating drink strengthens with its use. The only safe course is to shun the theater and the circus. And again, contextually, the circus in her day was not what it is today. The circus in her day was more like a sideshow, kind of freak show. It wasn't necessarily the zoo that it kind of is today. But maybe there's some aspects of that today even as well. And every other questionable place of amusement. Here's another quote. Many place themselves on the enchanted ground by frequenting scenes of amusement where fallen spirits congregate. It's interesting because this morning we were talking about Babylon and how Babylon is the home of every demon and foul spirit. That's what Revelation chapter 17 says about Babylon. Many place themselves on the enchanted ground by frequenting scenes of amusement where fallen spirits congregate. I mean, aren't there places that you go to and you just feel, I don't know, you know, I just don't know about this place. There's a reason why. Professing Christian, when you resort to the theater, remember that Satan is there. And he is conducting the play as the master actor. He is there to excite passion and to glorify vice. The very atmosphere is permeated with licentiousness. Satan presides also at the masquerade and the dance. He throws around the card table its bewitching power wherever an influence is exerted to cause men to forget their creator. There Satan is at work. That's the whole point. Forget God. Live outside of the presence of God. Ignore God in your life. It matters not how innocent the guise under which he conceals his purpose is. And here's the final quote. Satan's work is to lead men to ignore God. Our secular society today. To so engross and absorb the mind that God will not be in their thoughts. The education they have received has been of a character to confuse the mind and eclipse the true light. And I'm telling you, I mean, the morals and the values of Hollywood, I mean, there can't be anything more confusing than the moral lessons that they try to teach, or the immoral lessons and values that they try to share and teach. And our young people are confused today, and they don't know what's right and what's wrong. Satan does not wish the people to have a knowledge of God, and if he can set in operation games and theatrical performances that will so confuse the senses of the young that human beings will perish in darkness while the light shines all about them, he is well pleased. The irony about this, that the light shines all about them, it's funny because Paris is called the City of Light. What irony, don't you think? So much darkness there. And so what I call you to do this morning is I just call you to have a greater sense of the presence of God in your life. We're going to sing our closing song right now, Turn Your Eyes Upon Jesus. It's so important wherever we are at to just every moment and every day live within the presence of God, live with a consciousness of God. When we wake up in the morning, acknowledge God. Before we go to work, we acknowledge God. Before we eat our food, we acknowledge God. Throughout every moment of the day, to be able to live in the presence of God.
This podcast is brought to you by the Jacksonville First Seventh-day Adventist Church. Connect with us on www.jaxsda.org or on Facebook and YouTube. We look forward to sharing more inspiring messages with you.